This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 FM and 92.5 FM in good old McLean and surrounding counties. And also, our station in Pontiac is now broadcasting, and you can listen to that on 88.3. And that broadcasts up in Livingston County and Pontiac and the surrounding area there. So it's brand new. We're also hoping to get a station down in Lincoln, and we need your donations and your help with that, because that is going to be a $50,000 operation, but we would love to expand. We would be reaching around 1 million people in the broadcasting area if we're able to do that in the whole area that we will be broadcasting in. And we're brought to you by you. If you would like to make a donation, you can go to our website. That's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. You can call our station at 807-2427. That's 807-2427, 309 area code. But best it would be to go to our website at CatholicSpiritRadio.com, and you'll get a lot of information about us there, find out some of the things that we're doing. We have a board meeting once a month. You may be interested in something like that. And just get the information that you find there. It will be very interesting. We do have a newsletter that we put out, and that comes out quarterly. And so if you go to our website, you'll find out more information about all of those things. So it's a great place to visit. And we thank you so much for whatever you have been able to do, and wish everybody out there a Merry Christmas. And I'm here with a guest today, and that's Dr. Carl Winning. And Carl was the director of the ISU Planetarium for a number of years. Carl taught physics at Wesleyan University here in Bloomington Normal and also ISU. And he currently teaches a course in physics at Heartland College. He's active in the astronomy club here in Bloomington Normal. And he knows a lot about the sky. And he's going to talk in our Christmas season here about the Star of Bethlehem. So I'd like to introduce Carl. And Carl, if you want to talk a little bit about yourself or whatever you have to introduce your topic, go ahead.
Well, thanks, Bob. I really appreciate it. It's delightful, again, to be here this year. And as we mentioned a little bit earlier, we're going to talk a wee bit about the Star of Bethlehem. And so today, I think maybe the best way to take a look at this question of what the Star of Bethlehem was is to go to the book of Matthew, the second chapter, which actually starts the story of the Star of Bethlehem. And then, of course, we'll find a little later on there are other citations within the Bible that deal with it in a little bit more detail. And we'll talk a little bit about those today. So does that sound like a good approach?
That sounds like a good approach.
Okay, well, why don't I start off here by going ahead and reviewing Matthew 2, verses 1 through 12. And it reads like this. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him."
I'm going to ask a question real quick here, Carl. What about the Magi? Who were they, anyhow, if you could answer that really quick?
Well, unfortunately, we really don't know. The name Magi is a root word from which we see the word magician. And it's really not clear. Sometimes they're simply called wise men. But the tradition is that these were men who came from the east. We saw his star in the east. Now, that can be interpreted more than one way. Sometimes it's translated as "we saw the star at its rising." And of course, all stars rise in the east. And it wouldn't matter where you are in the Middle East, you're still going to see stars rise in the eastern portion of the sky. So in the end, really, we really don't know. They have been given traditional names, Melchior, Gaspar, and I can't remember the third one.
I'm trying to think of it also.
But I
know them when I hear them.
And yeah, I do too. So I've kind of forgotten them. Yeah. But yes, we really, really don't know for sure who they were. And we don't even really know that there were three of them. But we hear that there were gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And of course, it's assumed that each of the wise men, each of the Magi, actually brought one of the gifts. So we really don't know too much about them at all. But we do know that, well, at least that they appear to be a small group of individuals. So let me continue with the reading from Matthew here.
Sure.
When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. when he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Magi was to be, where the Messiah, excuse me, was to be born. In Bethlehem, in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. And then this is coming from Isaiah. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him. After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star that they had seen when it rose ahead of them went until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. So this is really pretty much what we have in terms of the Star of Bethlehem. There's no other direct citation in the Bible about the Star of Bethlehem, though there are many other things that allude to it, and not only in the Bible, but other extra-biblical sources that we know of as well. But, you know, as an astronomer, sometimes I'm asked, my bachelor's degree is in astronomy, my master's degree is in astronomy education, and people will ask me, you know, basically, especially at my time at the planetarium, you know, what was the Star of Bethlehem? And I said, well, we have to go back and take a look at the biblical passages here that we've just read in Matthew to see what kind of traits that it has to be able to explain. So if we're going to offer some sort of an explanation, it has to satisfy certain criteria. So what are the criteria from this passage? And that's a really good question. But if you go through this with a fine-tooth comb, as I have many times, these are eight criteria that I feel that this whatever it's called star was, had to satisfy. This star was first seen in the eastern sky. Obviously, the star had some sort of a message, or else how would the wise men known to have followed it? The star had a leading action. I mean, we hear that it went over and stood over the very house where the Christ child was. It appeared to them earlier and then disappeared once they've arrived in Jerusalem. Because then they start casting about saying, well, where is this child? The star had not been visible to Herod, the chief priests, or the scribes, because they had no idea what the wise men were talking about. The star reappeared upon the Magi's exit for Jerusalem, and they were only heading up to Bethlehem, which is generally considered to be about 6 miles away from central Jerusalem. So the star caused great rejoicing when it reappeared. And then, of course, finally, the star went and stood over the very house where the young child was. So it had to be reasonably close to the ground in my interpretation because, you know, look, during the summertime, we have a bright star, Vega, which passes directly overhead here in the Twin Cities. You'd never say it stood over this particular house, your house or my house or somebody's down the street, because it stands overhead at all these locations. But this star had to evidently be close because it came to the very house where the child was. And so also we know that it did not occur on the day of Christmas because, you know, at this point we know that Jesus was born in a manger, placed in a manger, and he was in a stable where animals were kept overnight oftentimes. And here now he's in a house. So it's obviously sometime after his own birth.
What might the star have been?
Well, there's been quite a variety of suggestions because people have been looking at this for hundreds of years. They really have. I mean, I think one of the first early astronomers was in the 1600s by the name of Johannes Kepler, who was very gravely involved with this question, deeply concerned with what it might have been. But here's some of the suggestions that have been offered over the years. Aurora Borealis or Northern Lights. For people who've never seen an aurora, I mean, it's quite an amazing thing. I was in Iceland just a few months ago taking a look and watching auroras because they're so spectacular. And, you know, here we are outside late at night, 11:30 or so, and all of a sudden this light comes up in the northern sky, and it moves up into the sky and takes on all sorts of shimmering and shaking and glowing and gets bright and dim, moves about, and seems to have some sort of a leading action, some people might think, and maybe because it sometimes swirls and scrolls and forms like little curtain bottoms and things like that, people said, oh my, a message in the sky. But let's admit, those things are really, really, really rare. Even here, but in the land of 32 degrees south where Jerusalem is at, it's almost unheard of. So certainly something very, very rare. But again, can this satisfy all the requirements? Could it stand over a house where the young child was and so on? Not likely. A zodiacal light, something I've only seen a couple of times in my life, and that is there's a lot of dust in the plane of the solar system. And sometimes when it gets dark fairly quickly in the evenings and the sky is extremely transparent, you can actually see light extending out away from the sun along what they call the path of the ecliptic, where you'll normally find the sun, the moon, and the planets over the course of a year. And that's visible, but it's really faint, and you have to know what you're looking for in order to see it. It occurs only when the sun is 18 degrees below the horizon or more below the horizon, because beyond that point, it no longer can add any light to the evening sky. So what light you see coming along the ecliptic is due to the zodiacal light, that dust in the plane of the solar system. Again, extremely rare. I've only seen it, like I say, maybe once or twice in my lifetime, and not very noticeable. One of the other ideas, perhaps a better idea, is this idea of a comet. Comets are flying across the solar system from time to time, and sometimes they can be rather spectacular. Some of you might remember some of the comets of recent past, Yakutake and so on, rather spectacular comets, Comet West and the like. Really quite amazing. These things, comets, the name comet is a very interesting name because it comes from a Latin word coma. And these were sometimes termed to be the hairy stars of the skies, cometa stellaris, they were called in Latin. But oftentimes these were considered rather bad omens that portended some sort of a disaster on the earth, the death of kings, doom and gloom, diseases and stuff like that. And so some people suggest even if you take a look at a 1605 painting by Giotto called The Adoration of the Magi, you can see the comet of 1601, which happened to be Halley's Comet. And some people have suggested that might be the Star of Bethlehem as well. Those of us who spend time out under the stars at night, well, maybe you've seen a bright meteor shooting across the sky, sometimes called a falling star. Those are really pretty amazing, but they're pretty common too. On any typical evening, you can see about six of them per hour. And they're sporadic. You know, they come from all different parts of the sky. You know, most of them are pretty neat, and people go ooh and ah. But because they're so common, I can't imagine somebody would think even a bright one.
They don't last too long either.
No, they don't. They're just a flash in the pan sort of thing. They're really, really gone very, very quickly. And so whether or not they can, you know, present any sort of a leading action or have any sort of a message, it's got to be a real problem. Another one of the things that has been suggested, this concept of an exploding star. You know, there's things out there in the sky, which we, you know, simply call new stars, novas, but they're not new stars at all. They're really old stars that have pretty much lived out their lifespans and oftentimes explode. And the Chinese are really good chroniclers of these things, too. And we've had a chance to observe many of these in my lifetime, and I've seen quite a few of these novas or supernovas over the years. But again, no leading action, no message or anything like that. Again, of course, there's sometimes, and this has been a very popular one. In fact, this has been one of the ideas suggested by Kepler, is that there might have been a gathering of planets or something of that fashion in the sky. And Kepler suggested that perhaps it was a triple passing of maybe it was Jupiter and the bright star Regulus and so on, that there is a traditional, not traditional, but it's an annual backing up of planets in the sky, that as the Earth moves past slower moving outer planets, those planets appear to go backwards for a period of time. And this kind of a triple passing of a star and a planet is kind of unusual. But last time that particular type of apparition occurred for us was 1982. And so that has happened many, many times. Some suggested that maybe Jupiter was occulted by the moon, as occurred on March 20th and April 17th of 6 BC. But unfortunately, that phenomenon was so close to the sun as not to be visible from Earth, generally believed.
Can astronomers go back to Jesus' birth and find out, was there anything? We know we have so much information from around the world now. Anything recorded of, that we would note at the time of Jesus' birth?
Nothing in particular. I mean, the idea of comets, roughly around the time of Christ's birth and so on, comets are fairly common. I mean, in my own lifetime, I've probably seen 20 or 30 of them. Of course, I'm looking a little bit more than the average person would be. And the skies were darker and probably more transparent back a long time ago. So people might have been a little bit more able to actually pick these things out and see them. So, yeah, it's really kind of hard to say. But, we can go backwards. I mean, I've got computer programs, and I've written computer programs that allow you to go backwards through time. And, I can go back today because we know the motions of the stars and the planets so well. We can go back 10,000, 100,000 years and very easily predict what the sky looked like from certain locations at certain times of day or night. And by being able to do that and to examine the celestial events that occurred during the supposed time of Christ's birth, which we really don't know with
accuracy.
That's
what I was going to ask.
We don't know.
There is so much dispute over Christ's birth. I mean, some people actually try to dispute it in order to, cast doubt on religion and on the whole story of Christianity. But the fact is that it's very difficult to know exactly, when
it is.
Was born.
Yeah. And the first attempt to really nail down the calendar in a way that, we moderns could understand it was the 6th century monk by the name of Dionysius Exiguus was given the charge by the Pope at that time to go ahead and figure out the date of Christ's birth. And, of course, we know, having looked at his work, the records are still extant. We still have access to those records today. He made a number of mistakes, which is quite understandable. Because a lot of times, you didn't have a regular calendar system out there. You might say it was the 3rd year of this emperor's reign or the 9th year of that emperor's reign. And so, it doesn't nail down to us like a modern system of, 1999 or 2007. It just didn't work that way.
That's true. And actually, the Jewish calendar, I think they had to insert an extra month in there every so often to keep the calendar accurate because it was off.
It's called the intercalary month. And the reason is that occurred is because the cycle of the seasons, which we use as a basis of our calendars today, 365 and a quarter days approximately, that was not the basis of the calendar back then. Back then, they used a lunar calendar. You might say to yourselves, who uses this lunar calendar today? Well, the Catholic Church uses it, believe it or not. Look at the date of Easter. What is the date of Easter? It changes. Well, why does it change? Why does it change? And it has all to do with the fact that we use a lunar month. And a lunar month is a year of 354 days. And, of course, that doesn't quite reconcile very well with the year of 365 and a quarter days, which is a seasonal calendar.
You can get quite a ways off very quickly.
It can be very, very confusing. Right. So, this is the reason the astronomers get paid the money to go out and keep track of calendars, because that's something we do quite well.
This is very, very interesting. I love this story, and I just like the way Carl relates the facts and the topics. We are going to take a break here, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
At Christmas time, your days are filled. You need to
clean the house,
plan the trip,
send the cards,
trim the tree,
buy the gifts,
get the toys,
wrap them up,
bake the treats,
make a list,
check it twice,
get eggnog,
write thank you notes,
hang the lights,
call the folks,
connect with friends,
and cook the food.
This Christmas, remember not just what you need, but the homeless, the poor, and those in need. Keep Christ in Christmas.
This message brought to you by the Knights of Columbus.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. We're back from our break. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. And we're with Carl Winnie, and he is a former director of the planetarium over at ISU, has taught physics in the area for quite some time. And is currently active in the astronomy club here in Bloomington Normal. And he's talking about the Star of Bethlehem. And up to this point, it has been extremely interesting and giving a lot of interesting information. And we'll just give this back to Carl and let's go on.
Okay. Well, we could talk a little bit about, you know, the year that Christ was born. Again, as we indicated, that's really not known. It's been suggested anywhere according to the calendar that was established by Dionysius Exiguus in the 6th century was probably off by a few days. And so today, or even by a few years, I mean, suggestions are, if you take a look at other writings, such as the writings of Flavius Josephus, who's a military officer, a general under the Romans. He was, in fact, a Jew. And he wrote a story explaining the history of the Jews and the traditions of the Jews and the battles of the Jews. And one of the things he talks about is the death of Herod. And, of course, he's almost contemporaneous with Herod because this is right around 70 A.D. when he's writing. And he suggested very clearly that there was an eclipse of the moon that was associated with the death of King Herod. And when we go back, as you had mentioned, you know, can we go back and take a look at the dates of events in the sky? We sure can. And we have found that there were four total eclipses of the moon that were visible from Jerusalem at around the time of Christ's birth. And they were on March 13th of 4 B.C., January 20th of 2 B.C., and July 17th of 2 B.C. So it's really not even clear to us which one of those three eclipses of the moon would have been associated with the death. And even then, there's question about, you know, the other information that we hear about the death of the holy innocents, you know. So the wise men came, and then Herod, after he finds out that he's been hoodwinked by the wise men, eventually sends out and slaughters all the young male children 2 years of age or younger in Bethlehem. So does that mean he waited for 2 years before he decided to slaughter the innocent children, by which time, you know, Mary and Joseph and Jesus would have gone down into Egypt for some protection? So many little complicating factors in there. So it's really, really, really hard to tell exactly. We were told in Luke, and this is another area where we hear a little bit more about the birth of Christ. It says in Luke 2, chapter 2, verses 1 through 7, "In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria, and everyone went to their own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in clothes and placed him in a manger because there was no guest room available for them." So again, like I say, this is some of the information we have that it's associated with, again, as it says here, a census that took place when Quirinius was governor of Syria. So this is how we keep track of dates back then. Again, it says that, you know, it's a time of Caesar Augustus. So again, it's so very, very unclear to us how we set the dates. So we're really quite unclear about that. Actually, we're probably more certain about the date of Christ's birth than we are of the year, surprisingly enough. You know, we always celebrate Christ's birth on the 25th, and you know, it comes from actually doing a little bit of mathematics from the stories that we hear in the Bible. You know, let me just go ahead and take a look at two arguments for this particular date. But before I even do that, I should say that some people will say, well, this had to be a springtime event because the shepherds were in the field watching their flocks by night. You know, we hear that as part of the story when it comes to the Star of Bethlehem, you know, this glory of the Lord that shone round about the shepherds at night. And then the shepherds are brought to the Bethlehem manger. And so the question is, was this a springtime event? Well, if you talk to Bishop Robert Barron, who spent time in the Middle East, he says, no, that's not true. Men were shepherds with their flocks throughout the year, and it has nothing to do with being in the field at springtime. So,
yeah, actually, I've read where they still to this day they keep sheep, you know, outside in the wintertime in
do.
Those areas.
Sure, because it's 32 degrees latitude. It's reasonably warm.
They had no place really to enclose them. They're big enough to enclose, you know, the sheep that they were herding.
No, and they certainly didn't build many structures, you know. So So it's generally believed that Christ was crucified on March 25th. Now, this may seem like a strange thing, but when you take a look when Passover normally falls, March 25th is a traditional date for his crucifixion. And there is an oral tradition that Jesus died on the same day that he entered this world through the conception of the Immaculate Conception.
Right, that he was conceived.
That's right. So 9 months later, from March 25th is December 25th, okay? Now, the other point that's sometimes brought up here is that Scripture provides evidence that the 25th is actually the date when Christ is born. How is that so? Well, the Gospel of Luke tells us that the angel Gabriel revealed to Zechariah that his wife Elizabeth would conceive John the Baptist while Zechariah was performing his priestly duties on the Day of Atonement, also known as Yom Kippur. That Jewish holy day always falls in late September or early October. Now, Luke also tells us that after Gabriel announced to Mary that she would conceive Jesus, she went in haste to visit Elizabeth, and that Elizabeth was in her sixth month of pregnancy at that time. Now, if you do the math, if Elizabeth conceived in late September and Mary visited her 6 months later, that means that Mary conceived Jesus and visited Elizabeth in late March. And if Mary conceived Jesus in late March, this places his birth in late December. So it seems that it's very possible the church got it right when they suggest that the 25th of December is in fact the birth of Christ, and we don't actually see a date for it in the Bible. But you can calculate that, and the conclusion seems to be reasonably obvious.
There is a little problem with that as well. I've read in Jimmy Akin, he says that the thing is that the temple priest, like Zechariah, served two cycles.
Yeah.
And those were 6 months apart. So if you guessed the wrong cycle, then it would be right. put his date in the summertime.
But
so
at least it's consistent as a possibility.
Very possible.
Sure.
Good possibility.
Very possible here. So then, you know, we can go ahead and take a look, too, then, with the whole question of things in the sky. And in, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, there's an astronomer by the name of Kepler who made some suggestions, which to me seem it on the face of it to be somewhat fairly good explanations for the Star of Bethlehem. But then again, maybe not. So let's take a look at here. Some of the ideas, this is in fact the one first put out by our friend Kepler, who was able to calculate planetary positions. He suggested that there was a triple conjunction between Jupiter and Saturn in the constellation of Pisces in 7 BC. Okay, that is Jupiter moving the faster past Saturn three times as it went through a series of what we call opposition cycles. And so that is interpreted. Well, it's got some sort of interpreted interpretation that says, well, maybe Jupiter is the king star, and, you know, here's Regulus, it's up there, and it's a star that's important to us here, and it perhaps represents the king in the king's house. Therefore, astrologically, we might suggest that this has some sort of a meaning to it. Well, I don't know so much about that. Clustering of three planets in the moon in Pisces in 6 BC, a spectacular appearance in the evening sky, but I'm not so sure that means a lot because I see that happening fairly frequently. Some suggest that there was a series of conjunctions between Venus and Jupiter in Pisces in between the years of 4 and 3 BC. And the fact of the matter is we see that sort of stuff happening fairly frequently.
Exactly. And these shepherds wouldn't be foolish people. They observed the night sky all the time.
This wasn't surprising to them, not at all.
And they knew it better than we do probably.
Yeah. So, you know, these things come up again and again and again and again. And, you know, if they're to lead the wise men, then obviously they had to have some sort of a leading action. They had some sort of have a unique message. But since this stuff does occur time and again, where's the uniqueness? Where's the message? Where's the leading action? So there's little problems with these kind of suggestions of planets and stars and things of that fashion being the signs of, that Christ is going to be born here. So again, first off, you can't really trust the astrology because we don't know the astrology during those days. And, you know, to think that Pisces represents the land of the Jews, and Jupiter is the king of the planets, and Leo is the king of the jungle, so to speak. You know, how that all ties together, that's modern interpretation, and they're imposing that upon ancient things the Jews never believed. I mean, in Judaism and even in Christianity, astrology is condemned. You know, and you can go on and find citation after citation in the Old Testament, especially where it talks about this sort of thing. Deuteronomy 18, verses 9 through 12 is really, really good example of that sort of thing.
I agree with you there. They simplify some of this stuff too much because even when you say the Jews, there were all different groups of Jews in different places, and they had different ideas about different things. So.
Yeah. And another one of the things, too, is like, you know, why would two planets be called a star? That doesn't make sense to me.
Exactly. And they knew the movements of the planets
sure
that they could
did.
See.
Absolutely they did. And then, you know, would a planet appear to stand over a particular house?
No. And even if it did, if it stood still in the sky, something like you say earlier, it would be very high in the sky, and it would be difficult to place it over any particular spot.
Yeah. And then would the star disappear? That's the other possibility. You know, you got to consider that. What do you mean by the remember the wise men, when they came to Jerusalem, they were wondering where this child was. And, you know, the sign that had led them disappeared. Planets don't disappear from the sky.
No.
You know, not unless it's a way that we know that they, you know, sometimes they disappear into the glare of the sun. But, you know, that's quite explainable, and everybody understood that who was an astronomer of those days. So I don't think any of those ideas really
satisfy. Seems like too much of an effort to try and push something in as a natural explanation.
Yeah. You know, the ideas that I'm expressing here really are not all that new. I mean, they've been around for a long time. But I think one of the problems with many of the works that are out there today is that they try to impose a physical explanation on the Star of Bethlehem. And when you consider you've got a story that's got stars that are somewhat, quote, miraculous, you've got things that are occurring which are very unusual. You've got stars standing over houses. You've got stars with clear messages. You've got virgin births going on. You got angels appearing in the fields by night. And suddenly people say, well, Star of Bethlehem couldn't have been a miracle. It belies logic to say that sort of thing.
And I think maybe our modern conception of a miracle is somehow that a miracle distorts or interferes with the natural natural law, if you want to call it that, natural things. And that's not necessarily true. You have to really look into the explanation of what miracles are more deeply than that.
Yeah, you do. Well, let's do that for a second. Let's then take a look at one of the possible scenarios here that in some sense might, in fact, explain the Star of Bethlehem. I'm going to read from chapter 2 of Luke, verses 8 through 20. And it reads as follows. And there were shepherds living out in the fields by keeping watch over their flocks at night. An angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were terrified. But the angel said to them, "Do not be afraid. I bring you good news that will cause great joy for all the people. Today in the town of David a Savior has been born to you. He is the Messiah, the Lord. This will be a sign to you. You will find a baby wrapped in clothes and lying in a manger." Suddenly, a great company of the heavenly hosts appeared with the angel, praising God, saying, "Glory to God in the highest heaven, and on earth peace to those on whom his favor rests." When the angels had left them and gone into heaven, the shepherds said to one another, "Let's go to Bethlehem and see this thing that has happened, which the Lord has told us about." So they hurried off and found Mary and Joseph and the baby, who was lying in the manger. When they had seen him, they spread the word concerning what had been told them about this child, and all who heard it were amazed at what the shepherds said to them. But Mary treasured up all these things and pondered them in her heart. The shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all the things they had seen and heard, which were just as they had been told. So there you have the explanation, again, of something unusual occurring at the time of Christ's birth. But if you're a Bible scholar, and I'm not saying I am one, but I do look at it quite a bit, especially in relation to the Star of Bethlehem over the years, you have to go back and take a look at that passage. And it says in Luke 2:9, "And the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were terrified."
Yeah, that's what grabbed me, too. I was just going to mention that. These people were used to seeing the night sky, and had they seen things that were natural that they had known about or seen before, even a comet, which implies maybe something, a messenger of doom, I don't think they would have been terrified.
No, I don't think so either. I think they knew what they were seeing, Because if you're familiar with the Old Testament, you'll realize in the Old Testament there's many, many, many locations in which the term the glory of the Lord appears. And it refers to the presence of God, a physical manifestation, sometimes called the Shekinah glory. If you will, let me read from a citation from Exodus chapter 40, verses 34 and 35, and then just a tad more here, because it talks about this glory of the Lord. And it says, "Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. In all the travels of the Israelites, whenever the cloud lifted up from above the tabernacle, they would set out. But if the cloud did not lift, they did not set out until the day it lifted. So the cloud of the Lord was over the tabernacle by day, and fire was in the cloud by night, in the sight of all the Israelites during all their travels." So if, again, you take a look at the Old Testament, you'll see it in many, many places, this glowing cloud of light, which is a manifestation of God's presence. One of the first places you'll see it here is in the covenant with Abram. There's a smoking pot and a blazing torch. It's suggested that this, in fact, could have been the glory of the Lord. That's in Genesis chapter 15.
And Genesis, by the way, if you know the seven days, the word, the number seven at that time means covenant. Mm-hmm. It's equivalent with covenant.
Hmm. And here's another one from Exodus chapter 3. It's the fire of the burning bush. Remember, Moses approaches the burning bush, and he's told, "Take your shoes off, for you're standing on holy ground." And he talks to the Lord out of the burning bush, the fire, the glowing cloud of light. It says that the bush was not burned. It was not a fire. It was, in fact, simply a glowing cloud of light. So that's the place you see it. And, of course, here we hear about the pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire, you know, that we see leading the Israelites throughout the time of their journeying in the deserts here. The tent of the meeting, we see all the time. The fire, the cloud, the thunder that surrounded Mount Sinai when Moses received the Ten Commandments, it's there. And I've gone on to take a look at the Old Testament and looked at how many times I have found citations of the glory of the Lord. And that phrase is used. If you just simply use a biblical concordance or do a search somehow on an electronic version of the Bible and look for the glory of the Lord, you'll find it in these places like Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Habakkuk. It's mentioned over 70 times in the Old Testament alone. 70.
Wow. We're going to take a break here. This has been extremely interesting up to this point, and we learn a lot, not only about the astronomy and science of the time, but of what the people wrote down in the Bible and things from the Bible. So it's very, very interesting. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Merry Miss! Merry Miss!
Merry what?
I said Merry Christmas!
It's so simple we take it for granted. Don't forget to keep Christ in Christmas.
This Christmas, are you getting or giving?
I'm getting video games, clothes, CDs, DVDs.
Well, I'm giving time to a shelter, gifts to the needy, and money to the homeless.
When you're making your list, check it twice. Keep Christ in Christmas. This message brought to you by the Knights of Columbus.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. We're back from our break. I'm with Carl Winning. He is my guest here today, and we're having a great, great show. I hope everyone is listening. And we're talking about the Star of Bethlehem, and it's been very interesting up to this point. So I'll turn it back over to Carl, and we'll see if we can wrap it up and maybe talk a little bit more about it.
Sure. Let's take a look at some of the New Testament examples of this glory of the Lord, too, because it's actually there, and in some extra biblical sources that I can take a look at with you as well. But first off, you know, the witness of the Father at the baptism of Christ, it talks about in Matthew about, you know, how the Holy Spirit is seen there at that time, sometimes descending as a dove, it says. This is the blinding light of the Transfiguration. You know, when John, James, and Jesus went up to the mount, and he was transfigured before them, and beside him were Moses and Elijah. And, you know, there's this cloud of light there.
And they were very frightened, too.
That's right.
They were standing
and there's a voice comes out of the cloud. "This is my son. I'm pleased. You know, listen to him." That's amazing. When Jesus when he ascended into heaven, he was received into a cloud of light. I mean, it's there. When you see the descent of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost, it's light again. It's the flames of fire, as it were. Then let's not forget the illuminating conversion of St. Paul expressed in Acts chapter 9, where he's going out and he's going to persecute the followers of Christ, and he's struck down from his horse by a bright cloud of light and the words, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" Again, all examples of the glory of the Lord. And it's just actually quite an amazing thing. And there are many extra-biblical sources as well that deal with this. One of the first ones that comes to mind is the Proto-Evangelium of St. James, said to be a gospel written about the early years of Christ that talk about his birth. And in there, there's a specific statement saying that, you know, Joseph had run out to get a midwife. And when he came back, he looked and found that the cave was filled with light, and that as the child appeared, the light went away. So Bishop of Antioch, wrote about the glory of the Lord and his treatment of the Star of Bethlehem. If you take a look at the mystic and visionary Anne Catherine Emmerich, a German nun, 1774 to 1824, who was beatified by John Paul II on October 3rd, she told the story of Christ's birth. Again, the cloud of light appears. So there are many citations that are extra-biblical as well.
I think Mel Gibson, in his book, in his movie, The Passion of the Christ, I think he based a lot of the scenes in the movie on her descriptions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's an amazing set of works. It is, and I would really encourage anybody to take a look at that. So, you know, I personally, I mean, it's a personal belief. And as a scientist, you know, I've got plenty of science background. I realize that I am limited. As a scientist, I cannot say the Star of Bethlehem was a theophany, a cloud of light. But I can say as a follower of Christ and as a Christian in my own heart that I do believe that the Star of Bethlehem was the glory of the Lord that's talked about in Luke chapter 2. I really do believe that. Now, some people say, well, maybe it's just a makeup story. Maybe it's a midrash. You know, I don't really buy that. It's the most important thing in our lives oftentimes when we think about the birth of Christ, his incarnation, you know, the Word become flesh and dwelling among us. I can't imagine that the church would surround that with figures of speech and with, you know, fables and things of that fashion. I really believe that they believed that this was true. And, you know, perhaps they didn't point it out to us as followers because to them in their days, this whole concept of the glory of the Lord was so clear. And today, if you ask people what the glory of the Lord is, they'll say, well, he's shining and he's bright and he lives in an incredible dwelling called heaven. That's what they'll oftentimes think of as the glory of the Lord. But the Old Testament, the way the Jews understood this, was quite different than the way we understand it. So to us, you know, we need to have it explained to us that maybe the Star of Bethlehem was, in fact, the glory of the Lord, because it is the only thing that could do all those eight criteria that we mentioned about. It could be seen rising in the east. It could have a message. It could lead. It could go over a cloud over the house where the child was. It can disappear, and so on and so forth. That's the only one that seems to satisfy it. Now, can I say that as a scientist? No, I cannot. But can I say it as a believing Christian? Absolutely.
And then the thing also we have to ask ourselves is, you know, what, in your opinion, Carl, what is the reason that so many people try so hard to fit a scientific explanation into, you know, this event and then, you know, various other events that happen, not only in our own Christian beliefs, but, you know, that have happened in the past of people's explanations?
Right. To me, it's just this whole concept of scientism. Science is a religion for some people. It really honestly is that it provides successes, answers, explanations. And because it's been so very, very good to us over the last couple, 300-400 years, science seems to have the answer to everything. And generally, science precludes any objects, you know, imaginary or real, that have nothing to do with the physical world. So God is certainly not part of that.
I think a lot of that, you know, the mechanistic, we of course don't today have an exact mechanistic concept of the universe, but that's still a term that's used among scientists and philosophers. Back in the 18th century, you know, there was this attempt to have a materialistic, mechanistic explanation.
Sure.
And that mechanistic, paradigm is still with us, you know, to this day.
It is. It is.
And so therefore, you know, scientism has become the idea that the only real knowledge, you know, the only knowledge that's really worth anything is scientific knowledge. You know, all knowledge is scientific knowledge, certainly what the statement would be. And that's what, you know, scientism is. There's a problem with that, though, isn't there, Carl? When you say that all knowledge is empirical, that sentence is not an empirical statement.
No, it's not.
You can't prove it.
You cannot prove it.
So if you can't prove that scientifically, you're sort of caught in a conundrum.
That's right. And that's why science is separate from religions, because science deals with empirical statements. You know, a statement like the moon is made out of green cheese. Is that a scientific statement? Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Is it a correct scientific statement? No, it's not.
No, but it is.
But it's something that's testable, and that's the thing we have to have. I mean, it kind of bothers me, like scientists like Stephen Hawking, who recently passed away, would state emphatically, God does not exist. How does he know that?
You're right.
It's not in the realm of science. A scientist, his claim is no different from any other person walking down the street.
It's not a scientific. Edward Fazer, in his books, he's a very good writer, and if you want to read about various things, he has one book out, you know, neoclassical essays, and he just talks about various topics in it. But the point is, he's talking in this one instance about where he's teaching a class on religion. At the time, he was an atheist, and of course, he's not anymore. But as he was teaching, he began to realize that there were many people in that class when he started making good arguments and reasonable arguments, you know, for the existence of God, you know, not trying to make scientific arguments, but just very logical, reasonable arguments. There were people in his class who were actually, you know, one girl, he said, came up to him afterwards and said, oh, I'm glad that you gave another explanation of why there might not be a God, because I was getting frightened that when you were talking, you could prove that there was a God, and that was scaring me. So, you know, there is a willingness to disbelieve as much on one side sometimes as there is a willingness to believe on the other side.
There absolutely is. You know, I've gotten away from the idea that there is an emphatic proof of God's existence. But I cannot help but believe that anybody who's logical and reasonable cannot draw a conclusion other than the fact that God does exist. And I've dealt with that many years because a lot of times students will talk with me after class and ask for a personal opinion about this, that, or the other things. And, you know, they'll sometimes say, well, science does not admit God, but what do you think? Does God exist? And I say emphatically, absolutely, I do believe. And they say, well, can you prove it? And I'll say, well, probably not really so. Because if I would give you a proof, then you would have to believe. But the fact of the matter is, you know, people have heard these supposed proofs, and they're not forced to believe. They simply choose not to believe. And I think that's a lot of times to it. So what I like to do is give people evidence for why I believe God exists. And if you don't mind, I'll even talk about a few of those here real quickly.
Sure, exactly.
Because I've always really, really liked this statement. It's by my friend, if you will, St. Thomas Aquinas. And he said, faith is the perfection of the intellect. And I think that's a wonderful statement, truly undervalued in this day and age. But faith is the perfection of the intellect. So what do you mean by that? He says, basically, if you look around you and you look at the world, you can draw natural conclusions that what you are seeing is that God is not in this universe without a witness. There is truly witness. Okay, so what are some of the witnesses? What are some of the things that I think about? Okay, given my background in astronomy, the mere fact that the universe exists is a mind-boggling concept. You know, we think that the universe began maybe 13.7 billion years ago in the Big Bang. But then the question, what about before that? People will say, well, it happened. There was a previous Big Bang. And a previous Big Bang? No, there wasn't. There doesn't appear to be any evidence to support that sort of a claim. If you take a look at the universe today, what we do, there's plenty of evidence to see that the universe is expanding. But there's also plenty of additional evidence that came out in the 1990s that suggests that the universe is not only expanding, but it's now expanding at an increasing rate, which is amazing, which tells us that the universe is actually being pushed apart. And nobody knows the nature of this pushing force. And maybe it's some sort of weird, you know, aspect of gravity. We don't know. But gravity's attractive, right? But now they're saying, well, maybe there could be dimensions that work on a large scale of the cosmos that are, in fact, repulsive. We really don't know. We call it dark energy. It's a complete and total mystery. But there's one conclusion that's incontrovertible, as far as I'm concerned, is that there was one Big Bang. It isn't going to happen again. So in the beginning, when God said, let there be light, there was light.
And this, again, it's the explanation, let there be light, the Logos. I mean, people, you know, try to sort of equate the biblical story as being the same thing as a lot of the pagan god myths. And it really isn't when you read it deeply. It is not that at all. It is a far more reasonable explanation of the universe than that. And, of course, it cannot be taken literally at all times. Some things in the Bible can, but much of it has to be understood differently. But it is not, you know, they were providing an explanation in their minds that was actually, you know, crowding out these pagan explanations. They were not reinventing some kind of a pagan myth type story.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that really kind of befuddles me is the question that was once asked of Albert Einstein, because he talks about, you know, the universe when it began as part of this Big Bang explosion. All space, time, energy was wrapped up in this Big Bang. And somebody asked him one day, okay, if the universe exploded and came into existence 13 billion years ago, whatever the current value was then at that time, then where is the universe? And he looked at the person and thought for a second, this is a really good question. Where is the universe? And he says, I have to tell you, I can only give you one answer. It's in the mind of God. It's just, wow, amazing thing. I remember when I was a student in Catholic schools back out in Ohio in my days, the nuns would tell you, if God ever stopped thinking about you for a second, you'll disappear. And like, wow. It's kind of interesting explanation here.
That's exactly true. I mean, so much about our own minds. You know, when philosophers or even scientists start to study the brain and the mind. And, you know, at first, a few hundred years ago, it was thought that, oh, well, you know, the explanation of the mind will come shortly. You know, of course, it's never come, because until you really start reading about that and get into that, you don't realize the enormous problems that there are between the two. And you begin to realize that, you know, if there are things moving in certain directions, that is teleology, if things have causes and effects and there are final effects and final, you know, ends, and you begin to really understand that, you begin to understand that a lot of things then in your own mind have to come from being in the mind of God. And it was said by, I think, a Greek poet, a pagan poet, by the way. I can't think of his name anymore. But Paul picked it up, St. Paul picked it up, and that is, in him we live and move and have
our being. That's right. You know, when you think about things like life, how is it that, we, who are composed of inanimate objects, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, iron, how is it that we have consciousness? How is it we have life?
Yes.
You can't explain life. We don't even know what life is. I've talked with biologists and others over the years about what defines life. They can't even tell me what defines life anymore. You know, they don't even know what it is, but it's something that's unique that we have, that simply we possess, which is not part of our being. There's something extra here.
Exactly. And that, you know, that is spirit. In other words, when the spirit goes out of us, then life leaves.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, there is something. You look at a dead animal. One minute it's alive, and the next minute it's dead. You know, what is the difference?
Yeah,
I
mean,
there are all the chemicals and everything. Everything is there, and yet we don't know how to reanimate it.
Yeah, and people say, well, you cannot believe in things that don't, you know, have a physical appearance. Well, what about love? Think about love. We believe that love exists, right?
Yes.
Where's it at?
Can't smell it.
Can't taste it.
Can't feel it.
Yeah.
Same with justice.
Yeah.
I mean, a little child understands justice very quickly. He doesn't have to be taught. I mean, try taking his toy away and he knows there's something wrong.
Right. We have consciousness.
Right.
And consciousness has a sense of right and wrong in it as well. And, you know, what about the existence of universal laws? Why does gravity work?
Exactly.
Why does electromagnetism work? Why do the strong and weak nuclear forces work? We simply don't know.
Exactly. And, you know, in other words, you know, cause and effect. There are, of course, people that try to deny cause and effect and say that cause and effect, you know, are just coincidental. But the fact is that everything, if we look at it and observe it, moves in certain directions. I mean, you know, when a rock hits a window, the window shatters. And it does that each time. You know, if you ask yourself if everything is really random, why should it?
Yeah, And I really don't think it is really random, because when you look at the universe, there's something called the fine-tuning argument of the universe. And if it were not for the fact that these things come together, the charge of electron, the speed of light, the permittivity of free space, the mathematical concept of pi, and something known as Planck's constant, if these things were not balanced just with the precision that they have, if they were off by more than a fraction of a percentage point, life in the universe as we know it would not be possible.
Exactly.
How is it possible that we even exist?
And in the universe, it could disappear if some of those things weren't, those equations weren't exactly as they are. If we didn't have a moon at about the right size and the right distance from us and so forth, there probably wouldn't be any life on Earth. I mean, there are so many things that people don't take into consideration. And they're not proofs, but they point.
They point.
That's called teleology. Right. It points in a direction. You know, things move in a direction.
There you go. There's that statement again from St. Thomas Aquinas. Faith is the perfection of the intellect. It's that little bit of leap.
Yeah.
And once you do it, you see it. And no longer is a proof necessary.
Because he always said, I believe so that I may understand.
That's right.
That's what he said.
True.
And this is what he meant.
Yeah. And let's not forget God's fingerprint too.
Exactly.
You've heard of that one. It's called the Fibonacci sequence. It's a mathematical sequence of numbers, which is really quite amazing, that seems to appear to be everywhere. It's in, we see these patterns in nature, like water crystals that form angles at 60 degrees, and they branch out. So you see patterns like that, but there's also another one called a fractal pattern, and it's based upon what's called the Fibonacci sequence: 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, 55, 89, 144, and so on. That pattern is replicated in such things as hurricanes, seed heads, flower petals, pineapples, pine cones, galaxies, shells, the human face, fingers, animal body proportions, DNA is all over the place. It's based upon an angle of 137.5 degrees.
Wow.
It's phenomenal if you take a look at the Fibonacci sequence. So, wow, the world is amazing. And I can only conclude that God has to have produced all this.
I agree. Carl, it's been really an interesting program. I hope everyone out there has enjoyed it. We're going to have to stop here. And God bless everybody out there. Everybody have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. We will, of course, be talking to you again. But we'll see you next week. In the meantime, St. Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do thou, O Prince of the heavenly hosts, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander through the world for the ruin of souls. Amen.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.